Good afternoon. So last time we talked about monitors, which was the combination of a mutex lock, the good kind of lock that actually has threads wait on a queue rather than using all the CPU on a core, checking if the lock is available, and condition variables, which were this abstraction that represented a list of waiting threads, and the condition variable had these operations that let us have a thread start waiting, and this importantly would simultaneously start waiting and unlock the mutex, so we could first check, do we need to actually wait, and not worry that before we started waiting, that whether we need to wait would change before we were actually on the list of waiting threads. And we had operations to remove things from the queue. We have a broadcast and a signal operation. And both of these remove, in the case of signal one, or in the case of broadcast, all the threads from the queue, and have them reacquire that lock and then double check the condition. And we talked about techniques for actually taking advantage of this to like do useful things. We gave an example of a producer-consumer where we have a condition variable representing threads that needed to wait for our queue to have data available on the consuming side and on the producing side where we need to wait for more space to be available in the queue because we had some capacity limit. So before I move on, any questions about the things we covered last time? Yeah?
For the spurious wake-up, will it actually have a lock when it does that, or will it?
So the question is, when a spurious wake-up occurs, which we said is that sometimes waiting, we might wake up when we aren't supposed to, when that occurs, will we actually get the lock? Yes, it's guaranteed that when you return from the wait function for a condition variable, that you have the lock at that point. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And last time, we finished up with this exercise on, here I have my producer-consumer code, and let's say I wanted to do, instead of consume, consume two. And if we're just replacing consume with consume two, we can just say, okay, we're going to wait while the buffer is too small in the consume, and then the produce, we're going to signal whenever we add something to the buffer, well, it's big enough that some consume two method could go. We could also decide that we're going to have support both of these methods, in which case we say, well, sometimes people are waiting for one value to be there, sometimes they're waiting for two, and we'll have a separate condition variable for both, and I will use the one ready condition variable when one thing is ready, the two ready when two things are ready, and I'll signal both because in the produce function, I don't actually keep track of who's waiting. And if I happen to signal, say, consume two, when consume wins, that's fine because they'll wake up from their con wait, they'll figure out, oh, I missed my chance. And it will still be correct, but maybe we could make this faster by keeping track of who's waiting and being more careful about what we whether we signal in both or not. Okay, so questions on this solution here? And we also had a solution where we supported both, but we decided we're just going to have one condition variable, and we're going to broadcast on it whenever we put something on the queue, and we'll let the consume functions figure it out. And this is a bit less efficient because now there's even more chances for both of these to be waking up and saying, nope, nothing on the buffer for me to use. But we have a correct solution, just waking more things up than we need to. In particular, because we're broadcasting, if a lot of threads are waiting to consume, well, we'll wake all of them up, even though probably only one of them can do anything. So, which might be why we prefer a solution with some more detailed bookkeeping and more condition variables, separate queues for different reasons to wait. Okay, so questions? mindfulness. Okay, so let's start with another exercise. So we talked about barriers, and remember, barriers were a way where we have barrier initialized with a number of threads, in this case, this total threads here, and we wait for that number of threads to reach the barrier before any of the threads would be allowed to go through a wait operation on the barrier. And the barriers you're most likely using for the life assignment are multi-use. Here, I'm just saying, let's implement a single-use barrier. So we're not going to worry about what about the next time. We're not going to worry about figuring out when to reset it and all that. Just single use. So we have some number of threads, which we're going to call barrier wait exactly once. And none of them should return from barrier wait until all of them have called it. So what should I do to implement this with monitors? I'll give you a minute. You can check with your neighbor. Okay, who needs more time? No one's volunteering. So let's fill this out. So, got a bigger. Okay, so what should I, can someone give me, what should I add here? Give me a solution. What's something I need that I don't have on this picture? Yeah.
Add a condition variable.
So add a condition variable where? Okay, so we'll have a Conti, what do you want to call it? What do you think is a meaningful name?
All reached.
All reached. So that's the condition that it represents. So what's our, so you say it's all reached, so our rule presumably is going to be that threads queued here are waiting for all to reach, and we broadcast on this when they've all reached. And this is how I like thinking about constructing this code. I say, I know what I need to wait for, and I can write down how is this condition variable going to be used? When are we waiting? And given when we're waiting, when does that mean I need to broadcast or signal? And now that I have that rule, I can write the code in barrier wait. Someone want to tell me what should I start with? One who preferably hasn't gone. What's something I need to check in barrier wait? Yeah.
Check if the number reached is equal to the total threads.
Okay, so we'll need to check if the number reached to the total threads, okay? And that's indeed something we need to check. I'll just leave these as blank lines. And what do we want to do in that case? So any of you all here, what should we do if the number reach is equal to the number of threads? Yeah. Broadcast, like I just wrote down. So we broadcast on the condition variable. Okay. So how about if the number reached is not equal to the total number of threads? What should we do in that case? A while loop. Okay, that sounds good. We want to wait in that case, and we know when we use conwait, we always have a loop, no exceptions. Because of spurious wakeups, we can't avoid having a loop. So we're going to wait inside the while loop on our variable and with our lock unlocked while we're waiting. So someone else can increment the total number of threads. And what's the condition on this while loop? What should we be waiting for? We should wait while what's true. And again, this is something where you can read the comment I wrote earlier, and that should basically give you the answer. Yeah. So while total threads minus number reached, which you just want to avoid the inequality, but we'll say, just to make it clearer. Okay, well, there's some number of threads that still need to reach the barrier. Okay, so questions about this solution? Yes?
Shouldn't we no longer have the if and else, and it should just be that while loop, and afterward you would broadcast? Because now you would never broadcast.
So you're saying, couldn't I, instead of writing this, I'll write the second version. I write a version where I just have this while loop and then broadcast afterwards. And the answer is yes, you could do that. This broadcast a few more times than we want to, which maybe isn't optimal, but is fine. Because we can always broadcast extra times without breaking anything.
Why would that broadcast extra times if it never does it while you're in the while loop?
So the question is, why would it broadcast extra times? Because when the first thread is woken up from the conwait, it's going to also broadcast. And if we have like 10 threads waiting, then the thread which figures out everyone's reached the barrier broadcasts to the other 9, then potentially the thread that's we do broadcasts which don't do anything after that for the threads that are actually woken up. But that's fine. It's not going to break anything.
So every thread is running barrier wait?
So every thread is running barrier wait, yes.
Okay. I was thinking of that as running on a separate thread and then notifying the other threads.
No. Because we have to have the code which increments number reach somewhere. So yeah, so another option, as you mentioned, would be we could have like 2 versions of barrier wait and run it on different threads, but that's not how I structured this barrier wait code. Okay, so any questions about this solution? Which I'm mentioning since it's likely you might need to like write similar kinds of logic for the pool assignment. So hope is that you're comfortable with that by the end of this lecture, kind of, at least, or comfortable enough to get more comfortable later on. Okay. So a note about using condition variables is that there's a destroy and init function like with mutexes, and also an initializer. Just mentioning this, there are also in the tutorial we link from the various threading assignments, but mentioning it for completeness. And most of my examples, I have omitted this code, the code which actually initializes things, but it is very necessary. Things will break if you don't do this. Okay. So that's monitors, and then we're going to take a break and talk about a different type of generalization of locks that supports waiting for events, and that's semaphores. So semaphores are something which has a non-negative integer value, so non-negative means zero or greater, and two operations. And the operations have a whole bunch of names depending on what book or paper you're reading. So we have a P, or down, or wait operation, which first waits for the semaphore to become positive, and then decrements it by one. So the idea is we're decrementing it, but we're never going to let it be negative, so we'll wait if it would become negative instead. Then we have a V, or up, or signal, or post operation, which increments the semaphore by one, which might wake up someone who's waiting. So these are our two operations, and it turns out that a semaphore like this can do everything monitors can do. Well, more than one of them can do everything monitors can do. Just use a bunch of semaphores and do exactly the same things we could accomplish with monitors. And that's not obvious. We'll explain, give a demonstration of why that's true, but it's definitely not obvious that these accomplish all the same things. And you might wonder about these names. So the names, as you see, horribly inconsistent. I will mostly use up or down, or wait and post. So up and down, I think, is the most intuitive names. Wait and post are the names that the POSIX semaphores have for the operations. P and V are from the Dutch, because this was actually made by Dijkstra way back. Yes, the Dijkstra of Dijkstra's algorithm. Yes, that Dijkstra. He actually did important operating system work and not just, you know, relatively common graph algorithms. Okay. So semaphores, I said, they represent integers. There's some things they don't do. So you learned that they're negative. We wait instead. The other thing is you cannot read or write semaphores directly. We won't actually be saying, what's the value of the semaphore? Except when we initialize it. We'll set it to an initial value, but other than that, we're never going to actually look into the semaphore to figure out the value. All we're going to do is the up and down operations. Now, if you look at the POSIX API for semaphores, some people in this class have noticed in the past there is a get value and set value in the POSIX API, or at least a get value. It is virtually impossible to write correct code that uses that, so please don't. And why is it virtually impossible? Because you don't know if you're getting the value just before or after someone did an up or a down operation. And because of that, it's really hard to think of how you use that correctly. So semaphores, we have to have sort of a different analogy. We can't easily think of it in terms of abstracting queues and this mutual exclusion. So I'm going to sort of explain semaphores with an example of, let's think of like reserve tracking copies of something. So in this case, we're going to say like a library book. There's three copies of a library book, and we can think of the down operation as, let's reserve a copy, and if there's no copy, well, we can't get it yet, we're going to wait. So just like taking a book out of the library, if the library's out of copies, you're not going to say, now the library has -1 copies. You're going to wait for the library to get a copy back. And the up operation is returning a book. So our semaphore is the count of the number of copies the library has. And we call down to reserve a copy, decrementing that count. And we can keep calling down until the count is 0 and the library has no more copies. And then when we call down, it's going to start waiting for a copy to come back. and calling up will return a book and cause our thread, which was reserving a book, to stop waiting. Yeah?
Would it be possible to go up past like 3 in this case?
The question is, would it be possible to go up past 3? Absolutely. So we can keep going up and up, higher and higher if we want to. Is that going to be useful? Not in this sort of case. Yeah?
If there are like multiple like down requests when there are no free copies, would they stack up?
So the question is, if there are multiple down requests when there are no free copies, what's going to happen? We're going to let one at a time for each up operation. And that's probably one of the reasons why, if you look at this intuitively, you can think, okay, up is kind of like signal, and down is kind of like wait, but how do we do broadcast, right? And we'll get to that later. Yeah?
Is there a standard ordering of which one gets up first, like is it a stack or a queue?
So the question is, if multiple threads call down and I call up, which one wins? Which down thread goes, and this is entirely system dependent, just like we learned with mutexes, like the operating system, like that varies between implementations. So in all the cases, like we could make an implementation which enforces a particular order, but most real implementations don't try particularly hard to do this. And when they do an order, commonly it's something like priority, not like an order, like. Priority as in there's priority scheduling on the system, so we'll have the mutexes and the semaphores use that too. Okay, so it gives sort of this explanation of the intuition for what semaphores are, is they're like a count of the amount of resources we have. And that's what makes them a nice abstraction, is that often we have real cases where that's what we care about. Like if we think of our producer-consumer example, we had a buffer with a certain number of slots. That's like library books in the sense of you want to reserve slots and return slots. So that's very nice. But it's not so obvious how we might do some other things. So I'm going to give some examples. So we can do mutexes with semaphores, and it's actually very simple. The lock operation is down, and the up operation is unlock. And we just start the semaphore at 1. And you can think of the semaphore as counting how many people can take the lock right now. And initially, one person can take the lock. And when you've taken the lock, no people can take the lock. And when you're done with the lock, one person can take the lock. And our up and down operations are just maintaining that count correctly based on whether we locked or unlocked. Yes?
Thanks, like a malicious user simply unlocked.
So the question is, what happens when we unlock a bunch of times in a row? Doesn't that do bad things? Yes. So generally, we have not talked about mutexes, conditioned variables, and so on, which are going to do the right thing if you use them maliciously. We will have to do a lot of extra work if that's something we care about. In fact, like if you think of our typical use of locks, we depend on you remembering to lock before you access something. Yeah, so if you're malicious, you're just going to ignore the lock entirely, probably. Other questions? Yes?
Is this ever actually implemented in practice, or do they use deadlocks?
The question is this ever implemented in practice? This is a... So I guess there's... Or do they use spin locks? So we haven't talked about how semaphores are implemented, and I don't actually plan on doing that. But like mutexes, semaphores are probably implemented with spin locks. And if you have a good semaphore implementation with spin locks, you might implement mutexes in terms of your semaphore implementation, or you might implement it also directly in terms of spin locks. It depends on what you think is cleaner and what might, maybe it's a little faster to use spin locks directly if that's something you want to do. But internally, the semaphore is likely to be implemented with a spin lock, so it doesn't make much of a difference. Okay. Other questions? Or I say a spin lock, something like a spin lock. Okay, so we saw mutexes. We can also do our, remember our first example of condition variables was this wait for finished. We can do that sort of thing, like a join. And we say, okay, if we want to do a join where we wait for one person waits for a thread to finish, we start our finish semaphore at 0. And you can think of 0 as representing the number of threads which can keep going after, you know, having waiting for this to finish. When we exit, we increment that to say you can go now if you're waiting for me. And when we join, we decrement it to say, you know, I want to wait for this. And this is a very common pattern with semaphores. You can think of this as sort of setting up a sort of gate to let one thread pass when another says OK. And in our thread exit, we're saying OK by using the up operation. In the thread down, in the thread join case, we're saying wait for the OK by using the down operation. So this is a very common pattern with semaphores and is another pattern you might just think about separately from our sort of library book example, as just a way to use semaphores. So this is sort of a wait for something to happen with semaphores is you start them at 0, use down to wait for the event, and up to signal the event to one thread. Okay, so questions on this example? Okay, so POSIX has semaphores. So they're in the semaphore header. Unlike everything else we've seen before, they don't all start with pthread for historical reasons. But they're semaphores. There's an init function. Wait is the down operation. Post is the up operation. There's a process shared value, which allows you to share the semaphores between processes. We haven't answered how would you have the same semaphore in two processes. We'll get to that when we get to virtual memory. Yes? This is part of POSIX. It's not part of what POSIX calls pthreads, but these days they're all essentially together. Other questions? Yeah.
Did you say there was a given set for some course that we shouldn't use
because it's very hard to use correctly. Yes, and you can figure it out in the man pages if you want it. Or, yeah, for the get and set. There's some other semaphore operations which you might actually care about, like there's a timed wait, for example, and things like that. And we don't expect you to want to use, but they're there. Okay, so we talked about semaphores. So here I have a little example. So I have a value, and put value is supposed to sets this global variable value and should wait to return until get value retrieves that value into its return value. So we have this pair of put get value and put value call, and the idea is that they're matched one to one and neither returns until the other is ready, you know, the data has been transferred. So the question is, given that, what should go in these two blanks? I'll give you a minute or two. Think about it, check with your neighbor. And also, if we have like two calls to put value at the same time, they need to take turns. and some of you were here, some of you may notice I didn't specify what the semaphores are initially, and yes, that matters. So part of this, you might need to figure out what makes sense for that. No. Oh, sorry. That is so. Someone over here. Da, da, da. So yeah. Okay. I meant to return result, and I don't have my pen with me today. So this should be result gets returned here, and so yeah, it's meant to return result, not the value directly. So you can actually do synchronization with getting the result and not just assigning a value for no reason. Who wants more time? Okay, who thinks? Some people. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so we seem to have some consensus, and that matches the pattern I have, and so here. And the idea is that empty is going to be set to 1 when it's empty and 0 otherwise. So in put value, we're decrementing empty to say no longer empty. There's no longer one empty slot. There's now 0. And that means in get value, we're going to increment it to say now there's an empty slot for you to put a value. And conversely, in put value, we say there's one value ready by incrementing the ready semaphore. So in get value, we're going to decrement the ready semaphore to say I'm taking a ready value. And this means that initially the empty semaphore should be 1 to say there's one empty value, and the ready semaphore should be 0 to say there's 0 ready values. So this idea makes sense. Yeah?
So you don't need initial values for...
The question is, I don't need to set initial values for empty and ready. I do, but I haven't shown you the code that we know called semi-init. So that must be somewhere for this to work. But it wouldn't be in the put or get value functions, because we need to have the semaphores initialized before we call either of them. So there's like something in main or something like that which is initializing empty and ready. That is very necessary, but not in these functions. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this sort of gets at one way of having an intuition for semaphores, which is that we can think about what is the thing we want to wait for. Is it an empty slot? Is it a ready slot? And try to think of something we can count That will be zero when we don't need to wait anymore. So for a mutex, we could think of recounting the number of threads that can start a critical section now. That's, so we had it be one before we locked, and we had it be zero while we were locked. So we were counting that number. If we think of our case of doing the thread join and exit, we were counting the number of threads that can join without waiting. Like, that was kind of convoluted to arrive at. But once we figure out this thing to count, which needs to be zero when we want to wait and something not zero otherwise, we can just use the semaphore to track that number and use the up and down operations whenever that count changes. Okay. And we're going to apply this to an example we saw before, which was our producer-consumer example. So one thing we wanted to count there was space in a buffer and free space in a buffer. And those are both things which, when they're zero, someone needs to wait. So this gives us a way of doing our producer-consumer example, but with semaphores. In this case, we'll do the bounded producer-consumer. So the consumer waits for the producer if the buffer is empty. So one way we can think about that is we can count the number of empty slots. When it's zero, we want to wait. And we just need to call the up and down operations when we change the number of empty slots. And the producer waits when the buffer is full. So we can count, The producer waits when the consumer waits when the buffer is empty. So you want to count the number of used slots, yeah. And when that number of used slots is zero, someone needs to wait, and we can increment it as we use more slots. And the producer waits when the buffer is full, so to deal with that, we can count the number of empty slots. When there's no empty slots for the producer to go, the producer's going to wait. And this gives us sort of the rule. And we have another constraint, which is that the buffer, we need to make sure only one thread, like, adds something to the buffer at once. So we need mutual exclusion, a mutex. So to have that happen, we're going to just use that implementation of a mutex pattern and have something which is one if a thread can start using the buffer right now and zero otherwise, which we'll use as a lock. So this gives us our semaphores. We have the number of full slots, the number of empty slots, and a mutex, so only one person tries to change the buffer at a time. And we have our fixed size buffer. So then we apply that, and we're basically going to do the right bookkeeping to maintain that number of empty and full slots, and also use this mutex to make sure only one thread at a time actually enqueues and dequeues. Because we assume our buffer doesn't handle that. You know, if two threads call enqueue at the same time, who knows what happens? Do they both get put in the same element of the actual buffer or not? You need to keep that from happening. And we're being careful about this. So we're going to say we're first going to reserve an empty slot. So we're going to first take out our empty slot from the library of slots before we put something in it. And only once we've put something in it are we going to increment the number of full slots. So there's this time in between while we're working on it during which we've reserved the slot, but we haven't given it away for the consumers to use. We've reserved it for the producers by decrementing the number of empty slots, but we haven't given it to the consumers by incrementing the number of full slots. And our consume is, again, the opposite. We wait until there's something available from the producer, then we dequeue that, and then we say, now there's a free slot in the buffer, and we increment the number of empty slots only after we've actually dequeued it, so it's actually free for our producer to use. Okay. And we have to initialize this, so I have that here. So we want to set the number of full slots initially. We have nothing in the buffer, so we set that to zero. The number of empty slots is initially however big the buffer is, and the mutex is initially one. We're ready for someone to start using the buffer. So questions about this code here? Okay, so one question here. Can I swap these? I'll give you like a minute. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree. Can we just swap the order of these? Does it matter? Okay. Anyone want to share an answer for whether we can swap these? No. Okay.
I would say no.
So no? Do you have something which would go? What do you think will go wrong if we try to swap them? So your intuition is something's probably going to go wrong because by taking the mutex, we're saying no one else gets to touch the buffer right now. And that might prevent someone from doing something important. The question is, what important thing could it prevent someone from doing? Well, the most important thing in this little snippet of code, besides getting the mutex, is waiting for an empty slot. So what we have to worry about is it might prevent someone from giving us an empty slot back. And that's precisely what can go wrong, is that it could be the case that our consumer got a full slot. Great. And now it's going to wait for the mutex so it can fill that slot. But unfortunately, by reordering this, now we're going to get exclusive control of the buffer and start, and then wait for that consumer which just got a full slot. And we're going to wait forever because we never actually finished that wait for an empty slot. Okay, so questions on this? So the order of those two weights really matters. And the way to think about it is, what are we reserving? And we want to not reserve the buffer until we know we have a slot in the buffer. We don't want to take the buffer before we actually know we can do something useful with it. Now, for the opposite operation, the post, it doesn't actually matter what the order is. And this is relatively easy to show because the post never waits. Like, it just finishes instantaneously, possibly waking something up, but it never waits, so it doesn't, this is not going to be a problem. So we could reorder, we could release our slot before we release the buffer, and that wouldn't cause any problems. Okay, so questions? Our producer consumer example. So that's producer consumer. So basically, we're just tracking this empty and full slot count, plus plus we had a semaphore to just implement mutual exclusion for the buffer, because our buffer didn't, we assume, wouldn't allow two threads to enqueue at the same time, or two threads to dequeue at the same time. Okay, so that's producer or consumer with semaphores. There's another variation on semaphores I'm going to talk about very briefly, which is binary semaphores. So there are common types of semaphores which are like the semaphores we talked about, but rather than have an integer that's zero to anything, they're just zero or one. And you might say, that seems awfully useless. How do we implement our buffer with that? But it turns out that these are as powerful as normal semaphores, in the sense that if you take multiple binary semaphores, like a finite number of them, you can implement counting semaphores. Now, it's not obvious how you would do that. You know, have it listed as an exercise, but it's actually a very difficult exercise. Yeah.
How does a binary semaphore differ from a monitor? In that they both have a weight function, and they both have a signal function.
Question is, how does a binary semaphore differ from a monitor? So a monitor, when we talked about it, had like one lock and one or more condition variables. So it's like split up into pieces. So we have like the same kind of operations here, but like it's on one thing. And the other thing is with a binary semaphore, we still only have an up operation. Like the up operation starts one thread, not we have no broadcast, which is sort of our fundamental thing with monitors. Another big difference that we'll get into again later is that with monitors, our typical pattern is that we check whether we need to wait before we wait. And this is not what we did with semaphores. With semaphores, we're just maintaining the information in the semaphore and using that implicitly. So like we always called the wait operation even when we wouldn't need to wait. Like in our producer or consumer example, produce would wait even the first time when that wait would happen right away because there was a free slot in the buffer. That's not what we did with monitors. With monitors, we said, get a lock, check if we need to wait, then wait. So it's a very different kind of pattern. Other questions? So, as I said, it's not obvious how you would implement this, but you can do it. So here's implementing counting semaphores with two binary semaphores and a variable containing an integer. So we have one binary semaphore, which we use as a mutex. So like with the pattern we saw, it's going to be one when someone can take the mutex, zero otherwise. And we have one binary semaphore, which we're going to use as a sort of gate. The idea is we're going to lift the gate when we want a thread to go, and put it down when we don't. And our idea is that we send the gate down when we're doing our down operation. We check the value, and if the value is still positive, we send the gate back up. And in our up operation, we first get the mutex and see if we need to undo the down operation, which net put the gate down. So notice that in overall, we put the gate down by one if we ended up with a value of zero. Now, there's a lot of subtlety here about does it really work in this order? I'm hoping it's correct because I copied this from a paper from the 80s, but rather than dealing with all the corner cases myself. Like, in practice, usually we'll use like counting semaphores because that's what POSIX provides and most other libraries I know provide, but binary semaphores do as much. And the patterns you use are basically these two patterns. You have the mutex sort of pattern, mutual exclusion, and you have this gate sort of pattern where you lift the gate to let a thread pass, keep put it down to stop a thread. And you know, you put the gate down to wait on another thread to lift the gate for you. So here, you can think of this first down as put the gate down to wait for another thread to lift it for us. And if that, you know, didn't do anything, put the gate back up for the next thread. And this is a common pattern with semaphores in general, and also gets back to sort of a difference I mentioned before, is that like we didn't have a broadcast operation for semaphores. Well, if you went to build one, this is a typical pattern you build one from. Is you'd have a one passed at a time, you'd keep a count, and you just go up that many times to let one pass, to let each of the threads pass the gate to do your effective equivalent of broadcast. You just figure out how many people are waiting, let's go up that many times to let that many threads pass. Okay, other questions? Okay, so our main textbook, Anderson Dahlin, doesn't like semaphores. Our view is that programming with locks and condition variables is superior to programming with semaphores. This is not a view everyone agrees with. If you ask Professor Grimshaw, he'll tell you to use semaphores. But their argument, just to give it to you, is that they think it's clearer to have separate constructs for waiting for a condition to come untrue and mutual exclusion. We see with semaphores, we use the semaphore for both things, both to wait for a condition to become true, like with that gate pattern, and for mutual exclusion with that mutex pattern. The other argument they have is that with semaphores, you have to verify that each down is matched with an up. You have to verify you're like keeping the right count. And they think that the monitor way, where you check the condition directly that you're waiting for, is more intuitive. And probably someone arguing in favor of semaphores would say, well, you just figure out what you're counting and there's no problem. You can prove that you're keeping the right count. This is what our textbook thinks. I prefer generally to use mutexes and condition variables, though that may have more to do with what I learned first. I think it's easier for our assignments, but we have had people successfully use semaphores for everything because they can accomplish the same things. So questions about, complaints about semaphores? So I said semaphores can do the same things as monitors. So let's give a sort of sketch of the proof of that. And the easiest way to prove it is to use monitors to implement semaphores and use semaphores to implement monitors. If we can do that, clearly they can do all the same things. So first, let's build semaphores with monitors. So we have a monitor, we're going to have a lock. We're going to protect some shared state, and we said that a semaphore has a count. So we're going to have a count. We know the count's never negative, so I'll keep it as an unsigned. And we know we need to wait for some condition. The condition is the count is not positive right now. It's zero. So we're going to wait for the count to become positive. We're going to have a condition variable for that. And then we're going to implement our down operation. We're going to get the lock while the count is not positive. We're going to wait for it to become positive with that condition variable. Then we're going to decrement the count and finish. In our up operation, we're going to increment the count, and we're going to say, oh, we might have made it positive, so we'll signal. We know that we can signal and not broadcast because incrementing the count by one lets at most one thread finish a down operation. Okay, so questions about this implementation? Okay, now, this is there's some subtleties here. And one thing is that you might want to say, why are we just always signaling? Maybe we should just check if the count became one. So there is an alternate implementation that does that. Here you go. If the count's one, we broadcast. Now you might say, wait, you can signal, right? And, do you really need to broadcast here? And the answer is yes. But if you replace this with a signal, it won't work. So the question is why? So I'll give you a minute or two to check with your neighbor. And the thing to think about is, let's say you have two threads calling down and two threads calling up at the same time. There's something which can go wrong. And this has to do with something we found inconvenient about monitors as implemented in the real world earlier. The question is, there a reason why there's not a while loop for the up? Yes. So broadcast doesn't release the lock. So there's no way that the count is going to change until we release the lock. So that's one reason why you can say, better not have a while loop here. The other reason why is that broadcasting once is going to wake up all the waiting threads, so that's enough to do. Broadcasting twice is just going to wake them up again, and it's not going to be useful. Okay, any thoughts as to what might be going on? Okay. So this is a subtlety, and it has to do with when we talked about horse-style scheduling versus mesa-style scheduling. If we had horse-style scheduling, this would actually be okay. Or should be probably okay. But here's a scenario which can happen. So we have down called by two threads. So those threads are waiting. And that's a good setup for figuring out, is the signal necessary? You want to have signal and broadcast do different things. If we broadcast in this case, we're going to wake up both thread one and thread two. But since we're signaling, we're only going to wake up one of them. So then we do an up operation, and we wake up one of them. And the question is, what can go wrong that causes us not to later on wake up the other thread when we're supposed to, that where waking it up earlier would have helped? And the thing which can go wrong is that we wake up thread one, but thread four here, running another copy of up, gets the lock first. And this is the problem here, is that the signaling didn't hand off the lock. So even though we signaled, the signal didn't say, run this next. The signal said, run it eventually. And the thing which ran after that was incrementing the count to 2. Then we decrement it to 1, but we don't realize that we still need to run thread 2. And thread 2 never gets to run. And just what we need to worry about here is you need to remember, when you signal something, it doesn't mean it runs next. It means it runs soon. Okay, so questions about this scenario? This is really subtle, and maybe an argument against monitors. So, yeah.
So if we change it back to being a count greater than equal to 1, we could use signal, right?
So the question is, if we changed it to back to count greater than or equal to 1, then we could use signal? Yes. But that's not the same as unconditionally signaling, because we know the count is always non-negative to start out with. So yeah, we could just always signal. So that's the solution I started with. You might say, is there a solution where we don't always signal? Yeah. And one way you could fix this is you could say, after we're done with down, we'll check if we might need to signal again. That would be one option. But this is still also a little sloppy. Right, this is another correct solution. I think the most intuitive solution is just say, we know each up requires at most one down thread to be woken up, so that's the easiest to reason about. But we don't know that only the ups that go from 0 to 1 require one down thread to be woken up. That's not generally true. So, questions about this? Yeah?
Can you explain that example?
Which example? This example?
Yeah, just the whole down.
So what happens here is we have two threads called down, and they both have to wait because the count's currently 0. Then we have two threads call up. One thread gets the lock first. It gets the lock first, it increments the count to 1, and says, okay, I need to signal now because I made the count become exactly 1. That means someone who was waiting on down might need to go. So it signals. And the semantics of signal is you stop waiting on the condition variable and start waiting on the lock. And because we have MESA-style monitors, not HOR-style, we don't hand off the lock. Instead, the lock just works like a normal lock, and someone gets it. And in this case, we're saying the thread which gets the lock is thread 4. Maybe thread 4 gets the lock because it started waiting for it first. But doesn't matter why, it gets the lock when thread 3 releases it. So it increments the count. And it says, oh, the count's not 1, so I don't need to signal, right? Someone else have taken care of that for me, even though that's not actually true. And the signal does eventually wake up thread 1, so thread 1 runs, but no one realizes that thread 2 also needed to be signaled. Is that? You're up. Okay. Yeah, so figuring out signal versus broadcast is sometimes a bit tricky because you have to just think carefully about what can happen after now and realize it might not be the thing you want to happen. In this case, we wanted the down to happen right away. It couldn't. It didn't. The up could happen. Another up could happen. Okay. And I assert, but I probably won't show you. Well, I guess I can do a... I'll do a sketch of, we can do monitors with semaphores, so we saw locks, and we can do condition variables with sem and post, and we just need to, like this, almost works, except that now signaling wakes up something in the future, which is kind of weird. So this works, but signaling wakes up threads in the future, because it increments the count for things that wait in the future. We could avoid that by keeping track of how many threads are waiting. So we just track the number of waiters, have everyone wait on this semaphore, which represents how many threads are waiting, how many threads to wake up, and we can just signal to wake up one at a time. And if we have code which wakes up one at a time, checking how many are waiting, we can use the same pattern to wake up everyone. So that's proof, just a quick proof, that yes, you can implement monitors with semaphores. So they are exactly as powerful as each other. Everything you can do with semaphores, you can do with monitors, and vice versa. So choose whatever you think is more convenient. But you might need to do tricks like this of tracking how many things to wait for and so on. So, and speaking of that, we're going to look at an example of something interesting we can implement with monitors or semaphores. And I'm going to talk about this with monitors. And this is reader-writer lock. So reader-writer locks are like a lock, but we distinguish readers and writers. And the idea is, for reading, multiple people can read something at the same time. The only problem is if someone's writing, we can only have one person writing at a time, one thread writing at a time. So we'll have a read lock operation, which waits till no one's writing, and a write lock operation, which waits till no one else is reading or writing. And this is very useful. In fact, it's so useful that POSIX provides them. Or say, POSIX RW lock, which you could use. We're going to look at this as a use case for monitors, because this is the kind of thing you might want to implement with monitors or semaphores. You know, some more complex synchronization, something that's not just a lock or a producer-consumer example. So let's implement them with monitors. So we're going to have a lock to protect state, and we need to track these conditions of wait until no writers or no readers and writers. So in order to wait for that to be true, we're going to track how many readers and writers are there. Just like you saw earlier with my monitors, with my semaphores implementing monitors example, tracking how many people are waiting, we'll track how many readers and writers there are. We'll just track them as a number. We'll use the lock to access those numbers so we know that there's no confusion about what the right value is. And we have some conditions for the things we need to wait for, when writers become zero or readers and writers become zero. So our read lock operation is wait for there to be no writers. When there is, increment the number of readers, and we're done. And we unlock the lock because we aren't modifying the number of readers and writers anymore. The lock is protecting that information, not the actual, data that this higher level lock protects. This is kind of similar to how we implemented, use spin locks to implement mutex locks. Here we're using monitors to implement a more interesting type of lock, using the monitor lock to implement that. So we don't hold the lock during the operation, we just hold it to do our bookkeeping. And our bookkeeping is changing the number of readers and writers and waiting for the number of readers and writers to reach a certain value. So our unlock operation is we decrement the number of readers, and if there are no readers anymore after that, we can let a writer go. And we signal because only one writer can go at a time anyways. Our write lock operation is similar. We wait for the number of readers plus writers to be zero, and then we increment the number of writers. And to unlock, we decrement the number of writers. And in this case, we're going to signal to wake up readers. And we'll also signal along with the readers to wake up another writer. Okay. So questions about how this works? So our key idea is we track the number of readers and writers. We only change it with the lock. Remember that we have the lock after this while loop because of how conwait works. It reacquires that lock. And we have it here. It reacquires that lock. So we know that after we wait that no one else has added a writer, only us. And we know after we wait no one else here has added a writer. And that's why this implements the properties he wants. So questions about this code? So something perhaps dissatisfying about this is that we're just signaling writers and readers, and often we'll have both waiting. And in this solution, we wake them both up, and they fight, and someone wins. Who knows? And you might say, can we do better? And absolutely we can. We don't want to wake up both. We want to choose one. And this is, in fact, a benefit. We can actually choose what we want. Do we want writers to go first or readers to go first? We can make a policy choice. Is it more important that readers are fast, or is it more important that writes happen quickly and don't wait for tons of readers for a long time? And we can make an explicit decision. So to make this explicit decision, what we want to do is sometimes we want to wake up readers, and sometimes we want to wake up writers. How do we want to make that decision? What's the information we need to know? It's on the slide, by the way. What is the piece of information we need to know to make that decision about whether we want to wake up a writer or a reader when a writer finishes? No one volunteers. Okay, so I say writers first. It's no readers go when a writer is waiting. So in that case, that means we don't want to wake up a reader if a writer is waiting. And if we want to go readers first, no writers go when a reader is waiting. So the information we want to track is how many readers are waiting or how many writers are waiting. So just like we track the number of things which are currently reading and writing, we can track the number which are waiting. So I'll do that here to implement what we call writer priority, where writers go first. So when someone tries to write, before they start waiting, they increment the number of waiting writers. So WriteUnlock can decide, oh, I want to signal a writer, not a reader, using that information. And we decrement the number of waiting writers when we're no longer waiting. So the idea is here, after a writer finishes, it can say, are there any writers waiting? If so, they're going to go. I'm not going to let the readers go. Otherwise, I'm going to let a reader go. And in addition to this, with this policy, our new rule about readers is that readers don't get to go when there's any writers or anyone waiting to write. If there's anyone waiting to write, readers shouldn't go because our rule is writers first. No readers go when a writer is waiting, so we'll implement that up here. That we'll check for there to be no writers and no waiting writers before we'll let a reader go. So we just have all these additions. We track the number of waiting writers, and we use that to determine when we wait and who we wake up. Questions about what I did here? Okay. And we can do the same thing if we want readers to go first. We track, are there waiting readers? And we do that in the same kind of way. And we say, our writers don't get to go if there's readers waiting. So we say, when there's no readers, writers, or waiting readers, you can go. Otherwise, you have to yield to those waiting readers or those readers or that other writer. And we use waiting readers down here to make a decision about who we want to go first. So questions? Yeah?
Is there a reason why you didn't choose to just use, couldn't you just look at writers, check if writers was greater?
The question is, why did I use waiting readers and not readers? So that's going to achieve a different effect. So most notably, when a writer finishes, there's likely to be waiting readers, but no readers. And if we don't do that, if someone comes in and does the write lock here, they might decide to go, despite our policy, if they manage to come in at the exact right time. And we want to prevent that no matter what. We can't rely on them having to be woken up because they might come in at exactly the wrong time, which is why our condition always needs to match up with when we're waking things up if we want to actually enforce when things go. If we didn't have the condition up here, then yes, usually we wouldn't go, but sometimes we would. Okay, that's what I have for today. We'll pick up with more about reader-writer locks next time.